Okay, last time we did the toast fists, Balei HaTosot, rubbing your tongue in the light. Today we're going to have some fun. Last time we did sort of an overview of the revolution that the Balei HaTosot wrought, and then we saw Rashbam, and we saw Rashbam's contributions not only to his commentary on the Gemara, and that revolution we're going to talk about more today, which we started to elaborate last time, but also Rashbam's commentary to Chumash, and this seismic shift among Ashkenazic exegetes from a midrash-based approach to parshanot to a more pshat-oriented commentary. And we read it last time, but if anyone wants to take a look back in this little handout here, the back page on the top right, you have the comments of Rashbam that we read last time with regard to the conversation with his grandfather, with Rashi, in which Rashi communicated to his grandson in this tender moment that had he had the opportunity to rewrite his commentary to Chumash, he would have done so with a greater pshat orientation. Less midrash, more pshat. And Rashbam even adds the phrase, which we did not emphasize, which we wanted to add as well. He talks about toward the bottom of the piece, he says, you know, we'll read that section again. It's about 11 lines down in the middle, in that top right section, right after the comma. First word in that line is Natanle. So he says, V'af ani shmo ben Rabbi Meir, chatano zatzal. So he's referring now to talking about his father-in-law. Rabbi Meir Rashi is the maternal grandfather of Rashbam. So Rashbam's mother was, I believe, Yocheved, married Meir, so that's Rashbam's father-in-law, and his maternal grandfather is Rashi. So V'af ani Shmuel ben Rabbi Meir chatano zatzal, Rashi's son-in-law, my father-in-law, says Rashbam, nitvakach di imo. Right? I argued not with his father-in-law, but with Rashi himself. I argued with Rashi. In other words, the grandson and grandfather had no problem duking it out. L'chamta shel Torah, in those beautiful ways. This is our tradition. Right? A bunch of lawyers 1,000 years ago already. Ulefanav, right? Talmudis, basically. Ulefanav, right? I argued with him and before him. V'hodeli, and Rashi agreed to me. She'ilu ha'ila lo p'nai, that had he had enough time, hayatzerich lasot pirushim achirim, he would have needed to write another set of commentaries, lefi hapshatot hamidchadshim b'chol yom, in accordance with the simple explanations or the pshat-based explanations hamidchadshim b'chol yom that are innovated each and every day. And then he continues, ve'ata yirua maskilim mashepirshu harishonim. Now the enlightened ones will see what the earlier commentaries explain. So a number of fascinating points. In addition to the beauty of the relationship between grandfather and grandson, see a number of insights here with regard to what was going on culturally in these circles at that time. You have the notion of pshatot hamidchadshim b'chol yom, this idea that there were new commentaries being innovated by Rashbam's testimony each and every day. There's a sense that there was almost a renaissance of pshat-oriented chumash learning at this time. Now, when we think of intellectual renaissance, for me, in the Middle Ages, I'm going to Spain. I'm off to the Golden Age of Spain. I'm off to the poets and to the astronomers, the philosophers, all of them. Right, even the court Jews and all that whole phenomenon, the convivencia that we discussed. But the notion of intellectual renaissance in Ashkenaz, that doesn't necessarily resonate with us. But there's new work among historians the last couple of decades discovering exactly this, that in the Jewish community there was this new movement toward pshat-based explanation, that just as there was a Talmudic revolution led by Rabbi Yutam, the other famous grandson of Rashi, so too with regard to biblical exegesis. And as I alluded to last time, there are parallels in the Christian world. During the 11th and 12th centuries in particular, there is an intellectual renaissance around biblical commentary, which is centered in Paris, but exists across France generally, and even Germany and England as well. And there are a series of patristic fathers, of monks, of others who are studying the Bible in a more pshat-oriented way, almost sort of foreshadowing the Protestant Reformation, where you have a real movement away from an intercessor who explains the text to direct engagement with the text. So here you have this parallel movement, really a renaissance of thinking of exegesis in Christian circles, a parallel movement along those lines in Ashkenazic circles as well. Again, we tend to think of this as a very dry period intellectually in Ashkenaz, but quite the opposite is the case. There's a real flourishing here. And this notion that, oh, in the yeshivas for centuries and centuries, all they did was learn Gemara, that's the only thing they did. Nonsense. Remember, when Rashi went to Germany, he learned Chumash B'Iyun with his Rebbe. His grandson was, again, one of these major figures, Rashi's own students. We have personalities such as Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, other people we're not going to look at in depth, but commentaries, exegetes who were writing at that time, whose books have been republished, by the way, in our own generation by Moshe Rav Kook in Israel, and you can actually go and you can read these commentaries. These are Rashi students, these are Rashbam students. They form an entire school of thought. Now, there is a really interesting and sort of sub-literature over the last, again, decade or two. How did this happen? Where is this coming from? And there's sort of a question, to what extent is this coming in parallel with Christian exegesis? To what extent is this an internal process within the Jewish community? Rashi discovers or moves toward Pshuto Shel Mikra, passes it on to his grandchildren, and so it's almost a more internal Ashkenazic process. But the scholarly consensus is that, of course, Rashi contributed to this, but that there's something in the air. That there's something that's going on that's parallel among multiple faith communities at this time, and there's just this sense of return to the text itself, that we have these legends that we've received that are crucial, that are important, but cannot ultimately be a substitute for actual study of the text proper. There is a leader in this field at Yeshiva University, Mordechai Cohen. He's done some work at Hebrew University as well. I was fortunate to take a number of courses with him, undergrad and then graduate school as well. And this is his area of Spanish and Ashkenazic exegesis, biblical exegesis, and he does a lot of comparative study. He argued in a book review exactly this point, that the more compelling evidence is on the side of seeing parallels between the Jewish and Christian renewed openness and engagement with the text proper, and that's the reference here, the Pshatot HaMidchad Shim B'chol Yom. So it's just a phrase, that there's a whole world there. And if you take a look, Rashbam is highly controversial. Rashbam will time and time again do things that, frankly, modern commentaries would, you know, they'd put you in Cheirem, and they'd increase your book sales by multiples of 10 and all of that. But things that are not necessarily, wouldn't not be accepted nowadays, that Rashbam, one of the grandson of Rashi, one of the greatest traditional scholars, was comfortable with. So Rashbam, for example, will claim, essentially he has a two-tiered system of Parshanot. What he claims is, of course, there's Midrash. Not only Midrash Agadah, but there's Midrash Halacha as well. But he argues the fact that we follow a certain halachic practice, that the rabbis interpreted a text in a particular way, does not preclude the possibility that there is an alternative explanation which is consistent with the actual pshat of even a halachic passage. So Parshat Mishpatim is a classic example of this. Parshat Mishpatim is Jewish civil law. So you have the laws of Shomrim, for example. So according to rabbinic exegesis, we know we learn Masechet Bava Metzia, and we learn about the four Shomrim. And there are four different categories of someone who is a guardian of an object. So I lend something to Jerry, so I can do so in one of four. You can act in one of four primary capacities. You can be a Shomer Sachar, or let's start with a Shomer Chinam even. You can guard the object for free, so you're not using it at all, it's there for safekeeping. It could be a Shomer Sachar, you're a paid watchman. It can be the inverse, you can be a renter, you can lease the object from me. You can be a Socher, or you can be a Shoel, a borrower. And so those are the four categories that we have. And each one has different responsibilities, because after all, if you're a free guardian, so then you're essentially doing me a favor. But if you're borrowing the object and not even paying a red cent to me, so then you have greater liability for that. And then we know that in American law, and so on and so forth. So those are the four categories of halacha. The problem is, those are in the Gemara, those are in the Mishnayot, those are in the halachic midrashim, all of that. But it's not in Chumash clearly. It's not obvious. You read it, there are maybe three categories, but it's not obvious that it's these. So now, if you're a biblical commentator, what do? You're traditional. You're rooted in the Torah. You know the Mishnayot. You know the Gemara. You know all of those. So many, like Rashi himself, will explain, well, this is actually a reference to this category of Shomer. This is a reference to that category of Shomer, and so on and so forth. you have these kinds of things. When Rav Yair Khan was here for Shabbat, he gave a shiur on the Shabbat afternoon at Lower Merion Synagogue about exactly this point in discussing these different categories. So Rashbam is an instance, I think he's even cited Rashbam's commentary, if memory serves. Rashbam is comfortable saying that actually, no, that maybe there are three categories, but that's okay, because what I'm doing in my commentary is I'm explaining Pshuto Shel Mikra. And what the rabbis are doing is they're explaining a deeper, traditionally rooted sense of what the text is meant to convey on the basis of rabbinic exegesis, with rules that were passed down to the rabbi, but they're rules that are not identified or identical with Pshuto Shel Mikra, and that's okay. Now, this is for someone who's sort of engaged in biblical scholarship, this can be very helpful, right? Because if I want to remain deeply traditional, but I want to be open to what the text actually says, and not to think that every single rule of Rabbi Yishmael Omer at the end of, you know, we say at the end of Karbanot, is the same as Pshuto Shel Mikra, that all of these hermeneutical tools that the rabbis are employing are not identical to Pshat. So is that heretical, or is that actually incredibly helpful to us to arrive at an honest and genuine understanding of the text? This is, among other things, I think a difference between what someone who's more modern Orthodox and someone to the right might be comfortable with. The Rashbam is a very important precedent for this kind of mode of thinking, that it's legitimate and traditional to believe, and intellectually honest to believe, that there can be these two levels. So all this is just hidden here, but this Pshatot HaMitchadshim B'chol Yom, these are not small stuff. These are really important principles. And then that next phrase, he says, Ve'ata, next line, first word in line is Ve'ata, Ve'ata Yiru Amaskilim, Amasha Pirshu Harishonir. Now the enlightened ones shall see what the earlier commentators explained. And he goes on and he explains, what does Eile told to Yaakov mean? He has a whole long discussion about that issue. But this phrase of Yiru Hamaskilim, so you might think, well, he's just saying, if you're smart, you'll pay attention. But it's more than that. If you look at Rashbam's commentary, throughout, he comes back to the term maskil time and time and time again. In fact, there are a couple of code words that he alludes to or refers to, and if sort of you understand to whom he is speaking, there's actually some sort of audience out there of maskilim. And the masculine are, of course, very different than the modern-day masculine, right? The modern masculine that we think about, these are masculine who are committed to halakha, as opposed to the masculine we talk about, but yeah, are intellectually enlightened. There seems to have been a group around Rashbam in France at this time of quote-unquote masculine. We don't know exactly to whom he refers. But again, we know there are other Pashtunim who are working on these issues, who are working out the dicta questions, who are working out what Pshuto Shel Mikra means, and this group seems to have been identified by Rashbam as the Maskilim. And that was almost a technical term. There's a referent there. And then he uses another phrase. He talks about Derech Eretz on a number of occasions. One example of Pesach coming up, he talks about what is the Derech Eretz-based explanation for Kriyat Yamsuf, for the splitting of the Red Sea. How do we understand that? Right. On the basis of Derech Eretz. Now, clearly for him, Derech Eretz does not mean Menschlichkeit. What he means by Derech Eretz seems to be modern, rational, scientific understandings. Okay? We're not talking about, again, a 19th century.
It would mean Shem Tower in Derech Eretz. So that's...
It's a phrase invented by Rav Hirsch in the 19th century. It does not meaningfully... I mean, you have Mishnah on Pirkei Avot, etc. But the usage of secular studies is... That's Rav Hirsch's extension of the term, which is a very broad usage. But yeah, Rashbam may anticipate that. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Just now that we're on sources, can I just take one step back? The Shomrim, where you said you could find three categories?
Yeah.
Where?
In Mishpatim, probably, because there are a couple of different cases, but you might divide them differently. It might not be the same three categories.
But in Mishpatim, you would see... Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Again, it might not be... Rav Khan kind of discussed this. Well, it wouldn't necessarily be the same exact categories that we would see.
Okay.
I'm happy to...
We can
walk it.
I want to walk through that.
Okay, yeah, we can walk
through
that.
So, Derek Harris... Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No. Finish your thought. This is something else. So you finish.
He's not unique in using the term that way.
Oh, he's highly is very much unique.
So Derek Harris was in that time would have
correct.
Been used.
Well, even Ruff Hirsch is using it a little bit differently.
Oh, I meant not Ruff Hirsch. I meant Rashbaum. I'm saying taking back to the core of what Derek Harris would mean.
The original usage of the term. Derek Harris.
That's the way of the world.
It means
right.
the hall. Okay.
Correct.
So that's the we have created this kind of into a mission statement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it wasn't always that.
Correct, but I think the breadth of the term is inherent to the term. Remember, the first usage of Derech Eretz in Tanakh probably has nothing to do with Menshelchet at all, and probably actually has to do with, believe it or not, physical intimacy, right? Kederech Kol Haaretz, it talks about Lot and his daughters.
But also there's another context where it means common courtesy.
Absolutely.
Also.
But not...
And modern...
Right. Not biblically, but you
not
have that. But you have Midrashim.
Temporary circles.
Right. But you have that already in Midrashim. You have that extension. That's not a new notion. But clearly, Derech Eretz also refers to making a living. That's in some of those Mishnah and Pirkei Avot. That's clearly the usage. It's inherently probably a very broad category. Going out to war, even considered by Rashi to be Derech Eretz in one context in Baram Brachot. So there's, I think it's inherently pregnant with breadth and meaning and sort of the notion that the typical behaviors of a civilized individual, what does it mean to be a member of civilization? And that all of these fall under that category and that has value according to the Jewish perspective. And I think for a first living in Germany in mid-19th century, so that referred to high culture. Mm. And that was just what it meant to
secular
be.
Culture.
Right, exactly. High secular culture. So going to the opera and all these kinds of things for him. So a little bit different than Rashbam, who's using it in more of an academic sense and specifically rational/scientific study. But nonetheless, I think it's all part of that the inherent breadth of this term, I think, allows it to be so pregnant with meaning.
So you made a comment a minute ago about the... Rashbam's reference to maskilim, and it was different from the maskilim that we think of in the 19th century, but who were really secularists. Mm-hmm. But wasn't there a school of rabbis who considered themselves maskilim, modern Orthodox rabbis?
Sure, that's a great point. There is.
In the modern sense, I mean, not in the Rashbam sense.
No, 100%. You have some really important instances of this. You have the Rashash of Shmuel Strassen, who's published, his commentary is published, in the back of the Gemara, is an enlightened traditional thinker. Reb Tzvi Hirschhaios is a great example of this, also a 19th century thinker. Did some extremely important, very broad-minded kind of work. Mm-hmm. In Germany, you have parallels to this. You have Reb Tzvi Hoffman, who's doing work on biblical texts and doing critical biblical work while believing in Torah Misina and these kinds of things. So you have, absolutely, do they call themselves maskilim or not? Some of them actually, some did. I think that that's right. This, though, is a little bit different. I think that's a great point. This is a little bit different in the sense that there's no other group that they're comparing or contrasting themselves with, but nonetheless, I think that that's right. So Rashbam is at the forefront and a major part of this entire movement, and you get just a sense of that over here, and I wanted to mention that. And that was sort of the first point that I wanted to elaborate. The second thing, and this is related but in a little bit of a different direction, is with regard to the Tosafists. So we discussed a little bit about their approach to Talmud study, and we'll come back to that when we examine Rabbi Yotam, which is our third piece for today. We talked about their philosophy a little bit just now, or their approach to biblical exegesis in particular. What I want to turn to now is the question of their philosophical engagement. Because, again, to come back, if we were to ask Spain side by side with Ashkenaz, we would typically say Sephardic Jews, thumbs up to philosophical inquiry, and Ashkenazic Jews, right? Not so much. Give us a Gemara, maybe give us a Chumash as well, right? Or Tanakh, if you're really going crazy. But, Averroes or something like this to study, philosophy, Mornevuchim, they clearly did not produce a text such as the Mornevuchim or Sanya Goen's Emunot Videot or these kinds of things, Rabbeinu Bachya, these kinds of works. So So that they did not do. And so for, again, for a very long time, scholars assume basically philosophy, Ashkenaz, really very little to talk about. At most, when we come to turn of the 13th century, we'll talk about Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, the whole group, a circle of Hasidei Ashkenaz. Again, you have another term that has different meanings in different contexts in history. So these are pietists. They're very far from being singers or engaging in Dveikut. And instead, these are very almost severe group that holds themselves to very strict halachic standards. They believe that halacha is not the final word, but is just a baseline for all sorts of additional stringencies that one must accept upon oneself. They would go to the mikvah at all sorts of, the men would go to the mikvah at all sorts of incredibly uncomfortable hours of the day as a way of purifying themselves. They gave themselves malkut, all sorts of different things. This group had their own sense of Jewish philosophy about them, where they took this idea of halacha as just the baseline, lifnim mishurat hadin. They made lifnim mishurat hadin from an interpersonal ethical category to a ritual one, and they elevated it to one of the fundamental principles of Judaism and everything that went along with that. You know, there were some Hasidei Ashkenaz who fasted 2 days of Yom Kippur. You know, it's the same thing. We don't know which day the original holiday was, so we should really fast 2 days. Okay, so if anyone's interested in signing up, well, pass around the sheets and you can go for
they
that.
Also fast on the 9th and 10th and Tevet, because they were fast on 8th, 9th, 10th.
That's a good question, 8th, 9th, and 10th, right? And even some did 3 fasts for Esther also. That was not uncommon.
Well, fasting was a whole different thing then, though.
Oh,
I mean, bad dreams, that there was a part of your life and part of the, I think, communal cycle, where people were coming in and out of fasts the way we don't hold it.
100%. It's one of those things that until we think about it, we don't even realize just how different our lives are than theirs were.
Yeah.
You know, another, we've mentioned hygiene as a very different kind of example of that, but they're just basic.
It's my favorite.
Right? They're just.
There has to be. Because I'm running water. My whole family knows, I believe, that's like strongly different.
That's beautiful.
But I think everything can.
But most of us, I think, just grow up and we don't even. Can't imagine. That's part of the value of history, is that it's learning to appreciate what we have. Of course, we're pining for the good old days, right? Wouldn't it be better to be back at the time of truly righteous people when they didn't even understand what germs were or how diseases work?
So you mentioned that the term Hasidim had different meanings and connotations depending on which period of Jewish history you're speaking about.
Absolutely.
So I'm aware that there was a group of Hasidim, or people called Hasidim in Mishneic times.
Absolutely.
So how did they, were they similar or totally different from the Hasidim you just described?
That's a great question. There's actually similarities to both. What we know about the Hasidim HaRishonim is the Mishnah and Brachot famously describes that they would prepare for an hour before davening, they'd daven for an hour, and they would, kind of breathe and for another hour afterward to come back down. And they would do that 3 times a day. And the Gemara even asks, well, how do they get any Torah study done? And the Gemara asks, well, the Siyata Dishmaya, God was with them. That's how they learn. But that's, so it's interesting that it's an emphasis on the value of davening is associated with them.
Yeah.
But it's also going overboard. It's a sense of, right? Right. So it has maybe elements of both. But those are the 3 major movements. I remember when I was in a particular summer camp one time, they had their little bookshelf there, and the Sefer Hasidim was perfectly nestled in the Hasidim, in the Hasidic section of the library. So like the Baal Shem Tov and the great Hasidic thinkers, and then your Sefer Hasidim. 500 years, 600 years between them.
Nonetheless.
Well, I have some better jokes than some of them. Bookshelf, so here and at home, but how did I end up next to? I'll get in trouble. Like, this author only knew that he would be in between my this and my that. How many times would he turn over? Okay.
Have a little press next to the Valley, just because it's funny. It's just funny.
I like that.
Thank you.
That was good.
I never would have associated.
Right.
That was good.
Okay, so usually when we think about the Tosafists, we think about in terms of philosophy. Maybe if you fast forward to the Hasidim, to these Pietists, maybe they have some sort of notion of a philosophy that's really worked out. Mm-hmm. But Rashi and Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam, and they just didn't do philosophy. That's usually what we think about this group. turns out that that too is probably a, not only perhaps incorrect, but almost like this, this, there's almost a bias to it. In other words, that we very often come in thinking, oh, these Ashkenazim, they were these backwater, closed-minded Jews. You know, they were like the Haredim and the, you know, and the Spanish, you know, the Spaniards who lived in the Golden Age of Spain, they were the modern Orthodox ones. And so, like, of course they weren't doing, right? Isn't that, that's kind of how we think about these things. And I, in all honesty, as much as I revere Rashi, I'm not sure that you draw a direct line from Rashi to some of the observant maskim that you were talking about, Jerry, or to a Rav Hirsch, to neo-orthodoxy, to mono-orthodoxy, etc. You don't necessarily do that, and perhaps rightly so. I mean, to draw a direct line from anyone to a different era is always going to be complicated, but maybe it's an even bigger jump when it comes to Rashi. But there's something knee-jerk about this, and what we now know is that they were engaged in philosophy of a very different sort, not necessarily one that we're totally comfortable with, but they were thinking about these bigger issues, and they were heirs in particular to an entire literature, an entire way of thinking that they then revised, but essentially incorporated within their own thought. This is an approach to thinking, and this is again what modern scholarship is finding. Dr. Kannerfogel, anyone familiar with the name?
Yeah.
He's also at Yeshiva University, and he's done a lot of work on... has he been here? He may have,
no, he's been scholar resident at a Pesach hotel.
Okay.
Where I was at. So I got
he's made it. Yeah. He's made it. Okay. The big time. Very good. Okay, that's nice. How's the tea room? Okay, tell me about the speaker. There you go. Okay, so he's written about this extensively, and he's made the argument, a number of others have made the argument, that Ashkenazic Rishonim were heirs to a tradition known as the Hechalot literature. What is this Hechalot literature? It turns out that from probably the 2nd to 7th century, and probably even starting earlier, there was in Jewish sources, and there's a lot of parallel in other communities at this time as well, but in the Jewish tradition, there's an entire literature that is philosophical, quasi-mystical in nature, that spends a lot of energy describing two things. Number one, the essence of God, or even somehow how we are to envision God, whatever that means, quasi-anthropomorphic texts that the Rambam is surely turning over, as they even mentioned some of them, very, very, you know, unless you take them as complete metaphors, but those kinds of texts, coupled with a series of texts that describe great righteous individuals seeking to ascend toward the angelic realms, to the divine realms, in order to entreat the Almighty on behalf of the Jewish people, or simply as part of their own religious journey. So things like the Pardes, the four who entered into Pardes, are viewed as not just appearing in the Gemara, but there are parts of the Gemara, the Gemara's Agadah, that are representative of this wider Hechalot literature. They not only find echoes in the Gemara, but there are a number of texts that are extra Talmudic that represent this approach, this philosophy, that describe, that have extensive descriptions of the angelic realms, angelologies, I think they would be called, right? Incredibly complex, sophisticated descriptions. So God's up on top, he's number one. And then immediately below God, you have, you know, Metatron, if you've heard that, if that's a familiar name. And then you have Akatriel right below him. And then you have ministering to him, a whole range of different groups of angels. This one's led by Michael, and that one's led by Raphael, and so on and so forth. And then opposed to all of those is Samael, who's the embodiment of the satanic forces in the world. And they engage in all sorts of different interactions. And if you go to, for example, the Dead Sea literature, you'll find wars between these different groups of angels. They're the angels of light. They're the angels of death. Some of these texts have sort of this this dichotomous aspect to them, where you have two different groups that are warring against each other, almost a Gnostic kind of piece to it. There are those who claim that early Christianity was born of Gnosticism, the notion of taking monotheism but making it into a trinity, where you have dividing into different groups. Zoroastrianism has pieces of this. Zoroastrianism was the prevalent religion in many of the Babylonian communities where the Amorim lived, so there's a lot of overlap there, and then Shadim are part of that. The demonologies are part of that culture as well. So you have this entire literature. I don't want to equate between some of these sort of Gnostic or dualist elements with the Heichalot literature, but there are significant points of overlap between them as well. And you have a whole literature surrounding these. So you have like the Book of Enoch, or Chanoch, which is a description of his heavenly ascent, just like the Arvash Nechnesu Lepardes. The Book of Enoch is this apocalyptic description of how the Messiah is going to come through this ascent, and so on and so forth. And you have a whole series of books like this. Another instance of this literature was known as one of the most prominent and frankly, for some at least, disturbing books of this genre was known as Shi'ur Koma. Shi'ur Koma, the size or measure of the height of God. A very uncomfortable book to be exposed to, quite frankly. Descriptions of this part of God is this long, and that part of God is that long, and this reaching, you know, this represents the Kisei Akava. It's like, okay, so you know what the Rambam was fighting against, right? These were prevalent. Remember, the reason that the Rambam made such a big deal of this fight against anthropomorphism is because people were believing it, and there's a lot of literature now about what Ashkenazic rabbis really believed, right. Even what Rashi believed about anthropomorphism. There was a recent exchange about this in a journal called Chakira, in which Natan Slifkin, right, speaking of people putting Cherem, and Saul Zucker, Rabbi Saul Zucker is a former neighbor. He grew up two houses away from my parents. He was principal of Frisch. He's now at, I think, Mag and David, which is a quasi-Sephardic high school in Brooklyn. He's a Chedi, known as a Chedi, a Rabbi Chade student. Rabbi Chade is in Far Rockaway, and there's a small yeshiva there of rationalist Maimonidean thinkers who are extremely committed to Maimonidean principles. The notion that we can absolutely prove the existence of God 100% would be, can't speak for Rabbi Zucker, but that might be representative of their approach to thinking. There's, among some of that group, there is a diminishing of the significance of emotions, that basically God creates with emotions, and our goal is to allow for intellect to rule over our emotions, which there's some legitimacy to that, but there are other aspects of that I find myself to be deeply uncomfortable with, and just unhealthy in lots of important ways. But that's what you find among some of these. So one of the aspects of thought is to defend Maimonidean principles. And so his argument, Rabbi Zucker, in an article published probably 4 years ago, he was responding to Natan Slifkin. Natan Slifkin wrote an article arguing that Rashi was arguably an anthropomorphist. Rashi, not like some no-name. But that these ideas were common at that time, citing Kanefogel as partial evidence for this. And Rabbi Zucker was extremely upset about it, and they went back and forth. It was a very interesting exchange about this. Whether or not Rashi believed in such ideas that we nowadays would call heretical is a heavy question. That's pretty significant stuff. It's pretty weighty stuff. But either way, it's pretty clear that there were some pretty serious scholars living around this time who took this idea of Shi'ur Koma literally and really understood, if not the book literally, then the notion that God had some physical dimension in one way or another, or at least physical manifestation, which might be different than God's essence, whatever exactly that might mean. There were real discussions around these issues. So that's one small example of how this Heichalot literature, for instance, Shi'ur Koma, might have had ongoing influence among French, German scholars, even into the Middle Ages. And that's just one example of this larger argument that this Heichalot literature was alive and well and continued to carry influence for this community. I gave you just one example, if you want to look, from the Gemara, of something that is typical of the Heichalot literature, which finds its way into the first couple of dafim of the Gemara, of all Shas, of Brachot. So this is Brachot 7a, Zayin Amud Aleph. So here you have, first of all, four lines down. Actually, let's start from the top of the daf. Zayin Amud Aleph and Brachot. Am Rabbi Yochanan Shir Rabbi Yossi. Starts a little bit faded. Rabbi Yochanan said the name of Rabbi Yossi. Nain Shagadosh Baruch Hu Mitpalel. From whence that God prays? How do we know that? Shne'amar, as it says in Isaiah Nishayahu, Vaviotim al Harkashir, Simachim Bivi Tfilati, I will bring them to my holy mountain and make them rejoice in the house of my prayer, says Yishayahu. Tfilatam lo ne'amar, says the Gemara, Ela Tfilati, it does not say their prayer, but mine. Mikan, again, whatever this means, Shakadosh Baruch Hu Mitpalel. This is not this abnormal for this kind of literature. These, it's not anthropomorphizing God, but it's almost personifying him, as it were. My matzli. So nu, says the Gemara, what exactly does God pray? Amar Rav Tzuzucha Bar Tuvia, Amar Rav, both perplexing and beautiful at once, Yihi Ratzon Mi Lefanai, may it be his will before me. Again, that's quite paradoxical. Sheyichbishu rachami et kaasi, that my rachamim, that my mercy conquers, overcomes my anger. V'yagolu rachamai omidotai, and may my mercy overcome, or literally roll over my midot. In other words, may it be the dominant element in my characteristics. That nahegim banai, and may I comport myself with regard to my children, the Jewish people, b'midat rachamim, with the characteristic of mercy, v'ekanes lahem lifnim mishirat hadin. There's that phrase. And may I enter literally with them in accordance with lifnim mishirat hadin. So even if the Jews are worthy of punishment, God davens to himself that his anger should be overwhelmed by his sense of love and mercy and compassion for his children. Again, what do you do with this? Just to begin to make rational sense of this is really very difficult. And then we have an example of an ascent. Tanya Amar Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, Pa'am achat nechnasti lahakdir ketoret lifnai v'lifnim. So this is already interesting. Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha said that on one occasion, maybe Yom Kippur, who knows, halachically would expect it to be Yom Kippur, but skirting the bounds of halacha are not completely abnormal for this literature, or at least a certain ambiguity around the edges. On one occasion, I entered to offer the incense inside the Holy of Holies. Veraiti akatriel ka Hashem tzvako. I saw akatriel, which would seem to be an angel, but who is somehow identified with God. What does that mean? So again, there is literature that would then unpack this kind of thing and explain. Well, it doesn't mean to identify or equate between the angel and God, but there's some sort of connection between them, or representation here, manifestation, something like that. Shu Yoshev al Kisei Ram ben Isai was sitting upon this exalted throne. The Amar Li Ishmael ben Ibar Cheni, and said to me, God, or Katriel, said to me, Yishmael, my son, the Kohen Gadol, bless me. Amarti lo, so I said, Yerzam lefanecha, shichbeshu, rachamecha tkaascha, v'yagolu rachamecha midotecha, the same prayer of God. V'tit nahegim banecha b'midat harachamim, v'tikanes lahem lefnim mishirat hadim. So the same prayer of God, he repeated in direction of the Almighty. V'ne'enali b'rosho, and Akatriel said, hey, thumbs up, right on, I'm there with you, every step of the way, I gotcha. Okay, right, nodded his head. And it says, right, v'kamash malan, shelo tehe, right, if it weren't a Gemara about God, it would just be cute, but it's cute and utterly perplexing. V'kamash malan comes to teach us, shelo tehe b'rchat hedyo kalabeinecha, hey, right, don't take the blessing of an everyday individual. That's one thing if God gives the blessing, but Yishmael, to give a blessing to God, right? Okay, should take that very seriously. And that would apply, then that's a practical thing, that would apply in our everyday lives. You don't have to be Yishmael Kohen Gadol, go up to Akatriel, God himself, as it were, whatever that means, and bless God that he treat us with kindness. So I can give any of us, can give anyone a bracha, and there's sort of a nice take home to this message. This is a fairly classic Heichalot-esque literature embedded within the Talmud Bavli, which is the kind of literature that had many other manifestations, which, by the way, I didn't mention yet, but appeared even sometimes as part of the Apocrypha. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in Christian Bibles, some of these were actually included and canonized into their larger Bible, and those continue to have influence over and be relevant to the Chachmei Ashkenaz as well. So this is a very different kind of approach to, number one, what Rashbam is starting to introduce. If you think about it, this does not sound like it's scientifically based. Mm. This is coming from a very different world. And then it meets this intellectual renaissance, which is almost a quasi, I wouldn't say scientific revolution, but that kind of sensitivity, which you find among the exegetes, the Christian exegetes of France at this time. So that's a very different feel to a very different texture, and certainly very different from the more rationalist inclined Maimonidean philosophies which you have in medieval Spain, especially in Islamic Spain. So it's very interesting. So the notion that Rashi and his colleagues were not engaged in philosophy seems to be perhaps stereotypical kind of view. We now know that their notion of philosophy was very different in many, many, many meaningful ways from what then became common in some Christian Jewish circles, and certainly from Islamic Jewish circles, contemporaneous ones. Clearly, we're talking about a very different approach to the discipline of philosophy and what it means to think about metaphysics and all these kinds of issues. Nonetheless, the notion that they had a real integrated worldview and philosophy is present and is true and seems to be something that that we tend to overlook, which I think is really important to mention as well. Okay. So that's the sort of two for three. So that's a few words about Rashbam's exegesis, about what philosophy looked like at this time. And there are many more of these books and works. And again, all this is pretty new research over the last three decades. There is a burgeoning of research of books, of conferences, of essays, articles, etc., on the topic of the Heichalot literature, where it came from, how early it started, its relationship to Gnosticism, to the Dead Sea sects, to early Christianity, to Talmudic Judaism, to medieval Judaism, all these kinds of things. There is to later mysticism, to Kabbalah. There's just a tremendous amount of output on this topic over the last number of years. So there's a lot more to say. Could have multiple classes just on Heichalot literature proper. A lot of work, Jewish scholars in particular, as you'd expect, doing a lot of this work in Hebrew and elsewhere. Some really, really interesting things being done around this whole topic. Okay.
By the way, was the dialecticism of the more modern times, was that heir to the dualism of this time? Was there any connection at all?
Great question. We don't know of any. That already, I could see that being a hypothetical thesis. I don't know if it bears itself out. But what I think is fair to say is that the rational scientific approach of Rashbam to the text and the new intellectual currents with regards to Talmud study, I think those are probably connected. I mean, we're talking about Rabbi Yehudah and Rashbam, two of the great leaders of that time who knew each other very, very well, were family and all that, leading to parallel revolutions that each have significant parallels among these scholastics, these Christian intellectuals at that time. So those probably are more closely connected. As per Mordechai Cohen's argument about the exegesis, probably say something parallel about the Talmudic study as well. Okay, a few words about Rabbeinu Tam, because he was the founder of the Balei HaTosfot in the modern sense of the term, especially with regard to the commentary in the Gemara. We saw last time a number of salient points about their approach to Talmudic study. We talked about the dialectical aspect of their approach. We talked about their embrace of contemporary practice, the sense that their own people were pious in the Crusades, or around, for example, we looked at Tosfot in Masechet Avodah Zarah last time, and we saw that the notion that you could not engage in commercial activity with your Christian neighbors was just incomprehensible, utterly impractical, and flew in the face of everything that Rabbi Natan's own community and the other Tosfist communities were engaged in. So they seek to defend the practice, and they come up with a whole host of different defenses. And we said that many of the areas in which Ashkenazim contemporaneously are more lenient than our Sephardic counterparts, right, which in the time of Kitnios almost upon us is hard to imagine, but it's actually true, is but many of the rare instances when Ashkenazim are actually more lenient than Sephardim is precisely for this reason. It's because embedded in our community there were certain leniencies that were due to contemporary conditions, that the Balei HaTosfot did not seek to always change those practices, but actually revered the members of the community, sought to defend those practices. And many of those associated with Ashkenazi communities all the way until today. So we gave the example of Bishul HaKom last time. Cooking in the home was an instance. A lot of them have to do with Jewish-Christian relations. The Avodah Zarah is a good example. Chadash is another instance of this, and other cases as well. So those were true of Rabbeinu Tam already. In other words, the dialectical approach, the value of contemporary practice, he defended those who gave their lives in the Crusades or took their own lives in the Crusades. Rabbeinu Tam was at the forefront of all that. So just a few words about him. Rabbeinu Tam is born in 1100. So he only overlaps 5 years with his grandfather, with Rashi. I remember Rashi dies in 1105. Rabbi Yonatan is born in 1100 and dies in 1171. Lives most of his life in a town called Ramru, which is a French hamlet not very far from Troyes, where Rashi had lived the majority of his life. And so he's right there. And again, he's born to Meir, the son of Shmuel, and Yocheved, Rashi's son-in-law and daughter, respectively. And again, as we say, he's the leader of the Tosafist revolution. A couple of salient points with regards to Rabbi Yonatan that I wanted to mention. The first is that, as many other revolutionary personalities, you did not want to mess. Rabbi Yonatan was a fierce and competitive individual. He held very strongly to his opinions. We discussed this when we talked about Rav Sandy Gold last year. There was the calendar controversy with Saadia, and there was a question as to what the date was going to be, and basically Saadia, it was in the question he was going to win. It was one way or another, he was going to polemicize strongly enough that his view would carry the day, and between that, his brilliance and his prominence, indeed that's what happened. Rabbi Yonatan very often the same way, although he did not always win, which is interesting. So, for example, one of the areas, I don't think there are polemics around this, but the question of the order of the parashot of the tefillin. Rabbi Yonatan, I mean, there were those who accepted it later on, Chassidim, who accepted that practice later on, but Rashi's tefillin, Rashi's order of the parashot on the day, the default set of tefillin nowadays is Rashi's order, not that of Rabbi Yonatan. Another interesting dispute where he did not necessarily win the day, but he had influence over, is actually right back there and in all of our homes, which is the direction, the placement of a mezuzah. This is subject to Machlokes in Rashi and Rabbi Yonatan, quoted by Toso in Masechet Menachot, where these topics are explored. According to Rashi, vertical. According to Rabbi Yonatan, actually horizontal. He would have it going straight across. In fact, Rabbi Yonatan says that he would do the same, if he had the option, he would do the same thing for his Sifrei Torah as he thinks he should do with the mezuzah. He would have them lying down. He would build perhaps deep Aronot Kodesh. He actually has one of his, there's a passage in his work, Sefer HaYashar, in which he says, I would have them piled up in that way. You're not sure if it's deep and then they'd be back to back to back, or they would be on top of each other, but he says that's considered to be most respectful to the Sefer Torah. And he brings the wonderfully uplifting and inspiring example of, of a human corpse, in which we a person who says, that's considered to be most respectful. So that's true of a human. A human is a walking Sefer Torah, the Gemara talks about. The same would be true for Sefer Torah, for the mezuzah as well. Needless to say, he lost. He lost in our shuls. He lost on this issue in our mezuzah. But it's interesting to note that whereas Sfardim, Paskin like Rashi, Sfardim have vertical mezuzah. If you go to Sephardic practice, it's very common to have vertical mezuzah. Someone who really keeps most if not all Sephardic practices, that's not uncommon to see. Ashkenazim basically follow Rashi, but the reason that we slant is in deference to Rabbi Yonatan. So it's basically like Rashi. Right? It's just right. It's no, that's it. That's
no,
exactly.
I thought it was actually a compromise. Like a midway, but I hear what you're saying.
Well, I'm just saying, if you look at the sources, the halachic sources,
it's without question.
It's we fundamentally paskin like Rashi, but Rabbi Yonatan. So even where we don't paskin like Rabbi Yonatan, it gives you a sense of the reverence that we have for his opinions, but that's an example of that. So Rabbi Yonatan, and sometimes he did win, and there were a number of enactments that he passed over others who disagreed. So you have, for example, he insisted that he had a takana. People were going to secular courts at that time, and he was very opposed to that. So he passed a takana, a very strong one, prohibiting going to a secular court, and you have to go to a Jewish court. And that was one example. I'm doing this with some of the students now in my Halacha mini course, so it's a nice overlap. You can ask your boys about it. He talked about there were cases of dowries were a big issue then. This financial disputes over dowries. He talked about a case in which a spouse, let's say the wife, for example, died within a year of marriage. Mm-hmm. they passed a takana that if that happened childless, then all the money would go back as if there was no marriage, because there were a lot of these kinds of disputes, and unfortunately it was not rare for someone to pass away within the first year of marriage. There were people who questioned the veracity of gittin, of halachic divorce documents that had been written at that time. When that happens, the system can be undermined. We have that with regard to conversions nowadays, and we know the ramifications of that, not just on a systemic level, but on a human level, yeah, for people who suffer through things like that. That shouldn't happen to anyone. Those are terrible things. And whatever we can do to avoid such a situation, we ought to. And Rabbi Nuhatam had that situation with regard to a get. So people were attempting to get remarried or were remarried, and someone would question whether or not the original divorce document from their first marriage was legitimate or not. Rabbi Nuhatam said, enough of that. If our local court passes something, how dare you question it? You have absolutely no position to say anything whatsoever. And that was another takana that he successfully implemented, put in practice. And one final one took place just literally weeks before his passing. On the 20th of Sivan in 1171, we'll have to come back to this as well, but in a town called Blah, B-L-A-H, in the French, B-L-O-I-S, Blah, was the first mainland Europe instance of a blood libel that was held against the Jewish community. The first instance was in Norwich, in Norwich, which is a British town, in 1144. So that's not actually part of the mainland, not continental Europe, but that was the first example that was somewhat distant from some of the primary Tosafist personalities that we're familiar with. But the French were the one that hit closest to home was, for Rabbi Nuhatam, was in 1171. And we're not going to go through the whole story now, but after this incident took place, the Jewish community was relatively unscathed physically, but emotionally scarred by this accusation. It was a very difficult time. And literally weeks before his passing, Rabbi Nuhatam decreed a community-wide fast day on the 20th of Sivan. I think I've mentioned earlier that it happened to coincide with the same date as the fast that was instituted for the Khmelnytsky massacres in 1648 by the Shah and the Taz. I've mentioned this previously in context of the question of instituting new fast days around the question of Yom HaShoah upcoming and not so long. Can we institute new days of mourning? Local, national, right? Purim was local. Purim was, those were local celebrations, and this is the inverse of that. But Rabbi Nuhatam says this should be, he actually writes, I'm not going to have time to read it today, but he actually says that it should be observed with greater commitment than Tzom Gedalia. It should be a major fast day for our community, and he puts that into place. And that, too, is something that's accepted by his community. So there were a number of his takanot that were put into practice and had major influence.
But is it observed today?
Is not observed today. Is not. I don't know if I was going to say that. I don't know if it's observed anywhere today. Certainly not widely. I don't know if they're any descendant, like a small group, but I'm not familiar with that. But it was well enough known for in 1648 for it to be picked up and brought back, and it was observed, I think, for centuries. So it had real impact. Remember, Yom HaShoah, we're only how many years out? It was put into effect in the 1960s, relatively new. So that's another instance of his influence. Just one or two more points, and then we'll stop for today. He was actually a poet. Rabbi Nuhatam was a poet. Which was unexpected for the Spaniards to see such a talented Ashkenazi, you know, someone so quick with his lips, as it were, and could do that. And there's a, maybe it's a legend, we don't know, but there's a story that he actually met Ibn Ezra at one point. That's plausible. They overlapped in terms of the times, the years in which they lived, and he greeted Ibn Ezra with almost quasi-Spanish verse. Huh. Some sort of creative witticism, awesome, or whatever it was. And Ibn Ezra was said to have responded something to the effect of, who has admitted the Frenchman into the temple of poetry? I think it was Moshe Ibn Ezra. Avram Ibn Ezra, excuse me. The one who's more famous to us. They're both had their poetry. Moshe Ibn Ezra also had poetry. But there's this sense he was used usurping that. But I think that it's not only, again, a beautiful moment, but there's this sense that we tend to live in a world of stereotypes, where we think, like, we put our Spaniards in one box and Ashkenazim in another box, enlightened, unenlightened, poetry, astronomy, philosophy, Gemara with a shtick or chumash or something like that, and so on and so forth. And we don't realize that actually they have their own rich philosophical worldview, and that Rabbeinu Tam was actually quite quick with his tongue, and he was able to hold his own, and Ibn Ezra didn't see it coming, but once it came and then some. So I think that there's something very broadening about this kind of thing, and I think sometimes we learn the most when we tend to see things in stereotypical boxes, and we start to break those down, and that's where real learning comes in. Because until that happens, we're just like modern politics. We just have our own assumptions, and then everything that happens, we just throw it in there and just put it in that box. And so what happens in that world is not only do we polarize, but we never learn. And we never grow, and we never see nuance and gray and sort of the beauty of what nuance looks like and what breadth can really mean. So I think to me that's one of the major take-homes of what we're talking about today. We still have to circle back to these blood libels and then to take that anti-Semitism streak and move from there. Next week, though, is pre-Pesach. Is our last class before Pesach. Are you guys, everyone, first of all, okay? Is everyone okay? Of course you are. Okay. Might be too much. I don't know. Okay.
I don't know if I can. I'm not thinking.
It's no problem at all. I am, just for the fun of it, going to do a pre-Pesach class. I'll do it in this class. I'm going to do it. In other words, I'm going to do something Haggadah related. And what I want to talk about, I don't know if anyone's going to be able to come, but I will publicize it, just in case people can do it. And what I want to do is to look at the, this will be good for Pesach, I want to look at the Haggadah as a text of Jewish-Christian polemic.
Oh, awesome.
Which is just a completely different way of looking at what the Haggadah is. And I think is mind-boggling and incredibly... It's just a paradigm shift in terms of what the Haggadah sought to do, what it does do, what it means. It explains many of the anomalies of the Haggadah. And just when you look at something from a historical lens, it can just be completely revolutionary. So I want to share some things about that. So that'll be for next week.
Oh, that sounds great.